Hello, and thank you for tuning in. I'm Anna Miljacki, Professor of Architecture at MIT and Director of the Critical Broadcasting Lab. And on behalf of the Architectural League of New York and the Critical Broadcasting Lab, I welcome you to our architecture podcast series titled, I Would Prefer Not To. This season of the podcast is supported in part by the Graham Foundation. I Would Prefer Not To is an oral history project conducted through audio interviews on the topic of perhaps the most important kind of refusal in architects' toolboxes, refusal of the Architectural Commission. By definition, the topic of refusal stays hidden from public scrutiny and thus also hidden from history. Withdrawals of this kind tend not to leave paper trails and are not easy to examine or learn from. And yet, the lessons contained in architects' deliberations about and decisions not to engage are politically relevant and urgent. Decisions to not engage a commission or types of commissions or commissions with certain characteristics inevitably forfeit potential profit, placing other values above it, at least momentarily. Today, I'm talking to Jeannie Gang. Thank you for joining me, Jeannie.
Thanks, Anna. Happy to be here.
Jeannie Gang started her own architecture and urban design practice, Studio Gang Architects, in Chicago in 1997. Besides Chicago, the studio, whose function Jeannie recently described as analogous to a rock band, now includes offices in New York, San Francisco, and Paris. Fueled by actionable idealism, the studio pursues new technical and material possibilities in order to create striking places that connect people, support environmental resiliency, foster equity and justice, and empower historically marginalized communities. The firm has developed a diverse portfolio of cultural centers and public projects. It has been reimagining academic and museum buildings, and following their Aqua Tower in Chicago, it has built numerous high-rise residential towers. There are many recent buildings to mention, and I'll mention just a few. Richard Gilder Center for Science, Education, and Innovation at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, Arkansas Museum of Fine Arts in Little Rock, Writers Theater in Glencoe, Illinois, the Arcus Center for Social Justice Leadership at Kalamazoo College in Kalamazoo, Michigan, and the new addition to Chicago's skyline, the 101-story St. Regis, Chicago. The firm is currently working on a terminal for Chicago's O'Hare Airport and many other projects. Jeannie is a professor in practice at the Harvard Graduate School of Design, where her teaching and research focus on the cultural and environmental aspects of buildings' reuse. She is a MacArthur Fellow, 2017 William A. Bernoulli Architect in Residence at the American Academy in Rome, and an elected member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. She has been honored with the Cooper Hewitt National Design Award in Architecture and was named one of the most influential people in the world by Time Magazine in 2019. Both Jeannie and the studio have received many more accolades, including Wall Street Journal Magazine's 2022 Architecture Innovator of the Year, the 2023 Charlotte Perriand Award, and Architectural Review's Architect of the Year. So, Jeannie,
wow.
I know the boards in your office are teeming with work, but as we do in this podcast, we will start by talking about the work that is not on them and maybe then loop back to some aspects of all of that work. So let's talk first about the most memorable decision to not engage or to drop a commission. And if that has not happened yet, can you imagine it happening and on what grounds?
Well, that goes way back. I think just to start with, I would say that in each case when a project comes into the office, I'm usually thinking about how it can change things. And that I would say I'm joined by my colleagues now that we meet every week and talk about projects and their potential to make better, change for the better, or maybe they are interesting in ways that you wouldn't think of at first. So we're usually coming at it like in a positive light to start with. And then there's, you know, just you can't do everything. So things, it has to do with very practical decisions about, you know, how can we staff the project? How is the project when is it happening and viable and all these different other aspects. But, you know, of course, there are times when you can't see how to align the values of the project. And but even in those cases, we'll spend a little time thinking about, could it do something before saying no, I guess. And that aspect doesn't really have to do with the profitability, as you mentioned in your intro. It's more about, will it have impact? And so, you know, I think the one that's most memorable for me is just, I'm an advocate for the environment, and I, right after we first started getting some attention to our work and firm, I received a request by mail, regular mail, to give us a commission to design, to redesign the interior of a cruise ship. So, and which, you know, it's very big. It's actually like, you know, a multi-story building on the water. And that was kind of a first time that we received a request from an international company to work for them. And so, of course, like, cruise ship is not an environment. Well, there's a lot of problems with the way that the cruise ship industry deals with waste, human waste, garbage, fuel, dirty fuel, all kinds of things that are just negatives and red flags right off the bat. But instead of just like ignoring the letter or just saying, you know, no, thank you, I remember writing a letter back to them and saying that, you know, the interiors are, you know, one piece of the project, but if they were to reconsider the whole waste stream of the cruise ship and think of redesigning the way that they work with the environment, we would be thrilled to help them in that journey. And so it wasn't really, in a way, it wasn't a no. It was like, let's expand this proposition. And of course, I got no response to this letter. but I think, and that's maybe a lot of times when we go back with this alternative proposal, there is not often a response. But I guess the thing is, I'm really excited about, and we are in general excited about, helping organizations like make transitions and change, especially to do with climate or other aspects. So those are really, they are opportunities that, you know, potentially could change things. So I like to look at it that way. Of course, I would say there are certain ones that it doesn't seem possible, maybe, and then that would be like a no. I mean, just a no. But those are probably not going to come our way typically, because I think we're known for, you know, working with environment and social justice and you know, really thinking broader about each project.
I mean, I'm interested both in thinking about or hearing from you how you define impact and registers for impact, and I'm sure that will come up more, but also sort of some quantity, like, do you say no often? It sounded like there are many things that come your way that actually don't need to think about too much.
We do say no often nowadays because we have many projects coming in, but it's not often like on these high grounds of, you know, moral no. It's really oftentimes it's just, you know, that looks really interesting, but we don't have the capacity to do it. Or, you know, because we really do think about the research involved in a project, and it's not just a stylistic thing that you can just crank out. You know, we need a little time to think about the project and to, if it's some quick turnaround, or maybe the person bringing the project doesn't seem honest about like the reality of that project sometimes, and you can kind of sense that, or, you know, that could be another thing. Or It could be that the project is, maybe it suits another type of firm better. Like sometimes we've guided someone to maybe a younger firm, or, you know, it's like, I would want to do it, but I feel like that's better suited for a different type of firm. So that's not, there's a lot of reasons why we might not do it, which are not also, you know, moralistic, I guess. But I think we do really take the consideration seriously.
So somewhere in your most recent monograph, you say that your practice is now organized around a few topics or a few interests, interest in nature, in culture, and in social justice, and that these interests are basically shared by everyone at the studio. And to quote you, you say it's not a standard set of criteria for organizing a practice, and it's not consciously following an existing model. So imagining that you're kind of finding your way in the world of organizing the practice. And what you say is, what I do know is that I or we just do what we want to do. And I thought we could unpack that a little bit. And I wanted to ask you to elaborate on this, both how this notion of sort of being able to do or wanting to do what you are interested in around these several topics manifests in particular projects or types of projects, and also how it works in terms of the mechanics of the practice. And you started actually saying something about that, sort of gathering people around projects to figure out whether it makes sense to work on it. But sort of the question is, when and how do you begin to assert these interests and commitments in the flow of a project?
The interests that I say are shared, I want to just mention that what you just described to me sounds very complicated, and that's not always a good thing for, you know, like from a marketing standpoint, let's say, to be complex. But let's face it, we are not a simple one-line, you know, one-liner kind of thing. And so that means that we are interested in different typologies, and we are, I'm always interested in how things connect. And I think today it's especially hard to be that way because of the media landscape that is surrounding us that wants just sound bites of things. But, you know, I don't want to let go of the complexity that it is to be an architect, to make these connections. And we're so well positioned to do that as architects because we see the political side, we see the environmental side, we see the programmatic possibilities. We talk to the public and general users of buildings. We know how to speak to technical questions. And so in, we're in this really unique place that isn't simplistic, but that's the power of it. So it's just not necessarily hard. It's not easy to communicate what we do and why we make these choices. But I think we will start out by thinking together about like the viability, like how, what does it connect to, not just the project itself, but like what's outside of it, outside the boundaries of it. Those are interesting things. We go after the things that really seem like potential, and it could be very tangent things in the beginning of why it's interesting and maybe not written down in the brief. So it takes some consideration, and doing that as a bigger group is more and more difficult, of course. So the mechanics of that is, you know, like the priorities of the subject matter, let's say, like it's about environment or climate, or it's about social justice, or it's about housing when housing is so needed. And it's a site that is a site that is pivotal in like the success of a certain place. I was just thinking about Memphis, just such an interesting city and such a great point, a turning point for them to want to address the river, the Mississippi River, and bring everyone to it. So that project, like, it wasn't obvious in the beginning, here is a site and it's a park, you know, it's not obvious that it's like in our wheelhouse or whatever. So you have to think, spend a little time thinking about it. And now we all try to do that with some kind of a grid that just speaks to you know, whether this is there's ambition there that you can sense, the values that the brief embodies, the kind of feasibility of it, like if it's from our side and from their side, I guess, and then just, you know, does it make sense for us to be the ones doing it? Like, you know, maybe we're not the best suited and we can steer that elsewhere, or maybe we have no chance of ever winning it, and, you know, with what the way that we're thinking about it. So, you know, those are the kind of criteria and the mechanics in this grid that we use to assess the things.
Do you feel you find yourself in a position now, at least, to be able to convince your clients or the public or the kind of constituents that are involved to go along or to agree with some of the interests and commitments that you have?
Well, Anna, that's interesting because, like, I feel so privileged now that we have projects and clients coming to us that share or they're like-minded, you know, that there's always something, the reason why they came, you know, and there's something that we connect about. And so sometimes it's like during a project, there's sometimes we'll bring something that they didn't think about, and sometimes they actually bring something we didn't think about. So, you know, we can work together towards something.
It's a conversation.
Yeah. And I mean, it's different than in the beginning, right? Where you are just trying to get a project. And so I think the takeaway is that any project can help, can, if you think about what is important about it, even if it's an everyday thing, you know, maybe there's something about it that can shift a little, and it helps you define your interests. So sometimes you have to, you know, just take a project that doesn't on the surface seem like anything. I started out with community centers. I mean, in all around in Chicago, different neighborhoods. But what, you know, they're not like, it doesn't seem super glamorous or anything on the surface. But what I learned from that was just talking to different communities, learning what matters to them, seeing after it's complete, like how it is important to a neighborhood, how it can change the way people feel about their community. And then I learned other things about it that we take into all of our projects, because almost every project is about being a community center in a certain way. Even if it's a residential high rise, there's a community aspect to it. So that's just to say that, you know, now maybe we're lucky enough to have like-minded clients, but, you know, there's always a kernel that you can find to connect with.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I also heard something in your response that's maybe about the kind of particular situatedness in Chicago, that obviously you're doing many other things now beyond Chicago, but maybe we'll get back to that a little bit too, sort of learning from your own kind of home. I really love this one other quote that I collected somewhere researching for today. It's from you, and it says, "Buildings, more than any other product of a creative process, are manifestations of societal values. In order to make them, architects must interact and collaborate with clients, governments, professionals of diverse disciplines, and a variety of stakeholders." And when this is sort of refracted against the vast body of your studio's work, it makes me wonder some of the things that we started talking about. Do you have any criteria for how you engage all or any of these collaborators? What makes for a good developer, for example? Are there any preferences you might have when it comes to engaging institutions or even types of work? Ground up, adaptive reuse, tall, small? Like, sort of, are there any sort of criteria there, or in terms of stakeholders, collaborators, conversants, and the kind of architectural object that might be arriving at the end of that process?
Well, I mean, you meet people where they are, and all these, I love working with different kinds of organizations. And what's really interesting is they make decisions in different ways. And so they behave in different ways. And so I think it's just seeing the whole landscape of that from, you know, developers to not-for-profits, and some developers are not-for-profits, to institutions, higher education, individuals, they all have different ways of making decisions, but also identifying where they think that they will be successful. And so that's, I think that's key to understanding how to work with each of them and to be effective with them. You know, like, for example, you might be able to do the greenest possible project ever with the most social justice goals when you're designing a center for social justice leadership and the client already has that. And that's one thing, but you know, that's one building too. It's only one building. Whereas if you are working with a developer that has a longer reach and they do many projects, you know, shifting an environmental approach that they might have not done before, like getting to over the finish line with them, can change everything for them going forward with other designers and so on. Mm-hmm. So it's important to realize what that, get back to the idea of impact and, mm-hmm. you know, how do you measure it? I don't think we don't have like a matrix for measuring the impact. It's more of a discussion internally and to see, you know, how that could take place.
So maybe this is still connected to some of that. I'm still sort of arriving at these questions or the meat of this topic from different angles. Mm-hmm. We're interested in, or we were looking at, the little triangular center for social justice and leadership at the Kalamazoo College, the building that I think you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. And there's a little conversation pit in the middle of it. And maybe the question is, because civic engagement is a common trope in many project descriptions in the office, I'm wondering how you negotiate between public needs and institutional or other types of clients? Or how do you think of your allegiances in a project? Or maybe how do you negotiate those allegiances?
I guess that is something where, you know, we were really starting pretty early with this idea of engagement. And, you know, it's, I take that back. I think there has been that from the 60s onward, there have been firms that are, you know, doing social impact and engagement, mm-hmm. and all that kind of thing. But I think it's just different as a firm that's known for our design, and more in the league of, you know, internationally known design firms or whatever, for us to do that was maybe a little different. But I think I knew there was something missing in our way of engaging. And so, and that also maybe some people know how to do it within the office and some people have never experienced that. It's not exactly something that was taught in architecture school. So we engaged someone to help us do workshops to learn more about, you know, how to talk with people, how to understand what they're saying, how to just get them to, you know, tell you what they think. So we were developing our skills on the one hand. And usually on the client side, it's really about trying to understand where their comfort zone is with the engagement process. Like, is it in the spectrum, you know, really just informing community, or are they interested in letting more of that come through into the design process? And so again, it's working together with the client, mm-hmm. I guess, and the organization to find the best way to make that engagement. And it doesn't, mm-hmm. not always at the outset. You know, we've had projects where an opportunity came up during the project that already was begun, but like, could we do a youth leadership group with the local youth and try to bring them into this process? You know, and that wasn't actually a real thing that happened with a developer, and they really embraced that and did it with us. So it's not a straightforward answer. I think it's again, it gets back to this, like, trying to meet people where they are and move the needle on engagement.
I like this notion.
Yeah. There's also this other thing that started happening more in New York than elsewhere, but there's now a kind of a really competent group of people that have started to make engagement their work, and sometimes they're architects. So that's interesting. On the downside, though, I mean, it's kind of like takes it more out of our realm of doing it. So it, in a way, it's becoming a consultancy, mm-hmm. which is good because it's people are being consulted. but then I always worry about, like, when we as architects lose capacities, you know, and we get more and more narrowed into a different kind of practice.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it sounded to me like you were enfolding these questions into the practice, and the idea that there are workshops internally for kind of helping maybe close the gap that the academia has already produced, right, in some way. On the topic of engagement seems important. But for me, it's also just a question of, again, back to the matrix that you said you don't have, but the kind of the matrix of priorities and sort of how one navigates, or how your firm or you navigate those priorities. Because obviously there are many interests and notions and ideas about where impact happens and different sort of constituents that get impacted. So how do you sort of manage that complexity is, you know, part of the question. Not that there is like a simple answer, but that's where we're kind of going, scratching that question. Mm-hmm. And you've already begun saying something about the fact that, you know, criteria for thinking about work have transformed since the 97 till now. But I wanted to see if you could tell us a little bit about how have criteria for the work that you take on and pursue and work that you don't take on changed over the course of the lifespan of the firm, and what would be the kind of major factors for that mm-hmm. change?
Well, one thing would be that having experienced a lot, you become slightly wiser about certain things. Like, I've seen that movie before and it didn't work out so well. So, you know, you can avoid some of those kind of things. And then having a little bit more, let's say, well, to have something be really interesting is still like at the basis of everything. To be want to do it, to have the exciting design possibilities, exciting, you know, movement towards zero carbon, or, you know, or innovative social things. And those are always just attractive still. But now, you know, with a bigger firm, I think we also realize, like, of course, we can't do everything. And so there's like limits, but there's also maybe it's helpful to talk about competitions, because those are ones where you say no because, you know, it might be an interesting idea, but you don't have capacity. But then you start looking at these things that are like, who do they really want to do this? Are they asking us just to have our name in the ring, or, you know, like, you start to think a little bit more about where it's coming from, and just to not, they're so expensive to do a competition. It's a huge investment of time and resources. Mm-hmm. So you do have to some responsibility to teams, and to your own, you know, soul. Like, you don't want to give it all and then it's already a done deal. So those are kind of things that we just use our, you know, past experience on, and mm-hmm. talk over like those kind of considerations.
Mm-hmm. Maybe this keeps us again in the kind of direction of what's challenging and interesting, but in an interview with Anne Louis for that monograph, the recent monograph, you talked about the desire to share a discovery as a kind of drive for the work. And somewhere in the same book you talk about, or there's a nod to research on tall buildings, which, you know, obviously exemplified in the body of work mm-hmm. on tall buildings. But I thought that it would be interesting to talk about the place of research in the work in the office, and also the role of sort of initiating or self-initiating research and maybe projects internally.
Mm. Yeah, that's a great topic and question, because sometimes research topics come out of projects and you think, oh, that is something we could go further with that. Sometimes they're just what's happening in the world. Like this is, like right now with the crisis of migrants or climate crisis or all these, there's plenty of things to choose from. But those things affect us too as human beings. And I often think, like, could architecture have something to offer to this situation? Not that it can solve everything, but it is part of our environment, and our environment defines us. So sometimes those topics come up independently of projects. Mm-hmm. And then they might start out with just the reading, like an academic approach, you know, reading on the topic, who's writing about it, what are some policy suggestions that have been made, and then trying to think if those policy suggestions, for example, could be materialized into architecture or space or public space or environments. So they could last. So at some point, it's time to test it with a project. Mm-hmm. Even if you just have to make it up yourself, the project. We did that, I guess, with the Polis Station, which was really about how could these investments that we have, which are public buildings that are called police stations or different things in different cities, how could they serve communities or build trust, better mm-hmm. relationships between police and community members? And that was not a project that was offered to us by police or communities. We thought of testing it and kind of getting back to something I said earlier, which is like these soundbite things. Weirdly, that project ended up being like seen as a as an investment in police, I think, by some people. So it was kind of like canceled by certain groups without even really seeing what it was, which was saying way ahead of time, like, we need to invest in communities. But anyway, that's just to say that anytime you do something like this, you're putting yourself out there for criticism, for, you know, but the point is to implicate architecture in the world and to show that it can, to explore, let's say, not show, but to explore what it can do, what it can't do even. That's what's exciting about what we do, I think. Mm-hmm. So yes, it is a risk, but it's also, if we don't take that risk or push it, then we're just, I don't know how to say that nicely. then we're just, it's a service provider, but service provider is not necessarily bad because there is a service needed. But we are
more than that.
Yes.
So maybe the question there, a kind of a mechanical question is, you know, I like the response, but more like, how do you carve out the space necessary for research, or what is the kind of that, or maybe not space, but time in mm-hmm. within the projects or around projects that somehow you're able to support mm-hmm. in the office, right?
Mm. Well, you know, these are things that cost time and research and people. And so you try to, there's some things that are a little bit ongoing. I mean, we do have researchers in the office and people working on that are dedicated to that. But usually you need other architects also participating. And so it's not easy, I would say, to do that. And you have to find, and now that, you know, this is more of a practice that we have, we're better at allocating, you know, the resources to it in the time that we can afford to do it. And with some kind of goal, it's not just, oh, it's so interesting, but it's, you know, towards something that can be seen by others, or engage with others, and or in dialogue with others. So it might be end up into a book project or an exhibition, or, you know, maybe sometimes even a real project, like the work that we did on the Chicago River and its pollution and its bad state of affairs, let's say, and the unawareness of most people about it. Work that we did on that was partnering with people like NRDC or, you know, other foundations that could help bring about something. It actually, that ended up in a project, in doing a project for these boat houses to give access to the river, and to create, the idea being to create a whole new generation of stewards for the river. So like make it bigger than ourselves somehow. I love that. And that project is great because it's now a while ago, but an ongoing observation of like what's happening with the river. It's a real renaissance of, and just so many people are connected to it and doing things for it. And it's just, it's snowballed in a way over the 10 years since we started with that project. So that feels good. And, you know, it's like, you can see the power of that. So that's, I get really excited about that kind of thing.
The way you did describe sort of research flowing through the office in ways that remind me of a band jamming. So I'm starting to see, that how that analogy might work in the context of the office. Now, I watched you show various birds' nests in a short video about the office. And in this one, you also demonstrated how water melts its paths through a big ice cube. And of course, both of these are providing material and formal inspiration and maybe lessons from the environmental and ecological realm for architecture. On the other hand, you also offer this contradictory coupling of actionable idealism as a driver. And I wondered if it would be fair to try to connect between those two in some way, or would you say that you precisely keep the formal and the political on separate registers, and there is value in doing that for particular reasons, or sort of just, can we connect these two realms, and is it worth doing that?
Yeah. Well, the actionable idealism is really like that for me. It came up because people were like, why are you interested in this? Why are you doing that? And it's really a why thing, because I want to see, I am idealistic and we are idealistic, but then we get motivated by seeing something happen and make progress on some idea. And so that's more like a why thing. But then, yes, it does connect, because when you think about, you're looking for these analogies maybe to a design, or it's maybe it's how the design might be made, or what it's made out of, or what it does for people. Those are like coming together between material ideas. Like the nest, for example, is just, you know, birds only use a nest for one time when they are, and then they build a new one. So I just want to say that, because I think what I learned from them, though, is that, you know, like there's this use of all these available materials, things that are nearby, and this light touch of energy put into those structures, but they serve a really important purpose and they're very local. So they make a good let's say, metaphor for a project that, like that. And so they're inspiring to me. A lot of animal architecture is inspiring for that reason, for how minimal energy can go to the maximal comfort, let's say. And with the materials, when you start thinking about, we used to think about reusing materials, like using it in something that's taken from a demolished building and how we can reuse that. But now it's more like, how can we reuse whole buildings? And what are some really, what are the most successful ways of reducing embodied energy on projects? Those are kind of really interesting questions when you think about the means and methods of a building. Mm-hmm. How can we as architects, a lot of people already start out like, I want to tear this down and start a new building. So can we bring some intelligence to that to help people make smart decisions about what they already have? And if it's needed to get rid of it, or could it, you know, be amplified or added to save all that carbon that's already in the building and just increase the intensity of the use of the building. Mm-hmm. Though that's really exciting. Mm-hmm. So let's see, I got lost. I'm talking about just in general, everything we do is not just the form. But the form is important. It's super important because beauty is important and inspiring people is important. But it's also like, how does it become, how does it get made? Mm-hmm. I love working on projects that care about that.
That's great. Can I go back to birds?
Yes.
For a second. So I wanted to go back to birds because they are also understood as constituents in some of your work. And I know that the studio has been advocating for, or you specifically have been advocating for, regulations that might save birds in the world of tall glass towers. So I thought that that would be mm-hmm. something interesting to also discuss, the kind of advocacy or maybe idealism around the birds that actually becomes eventually a kind of regulation.
Oh, you know, I love this question because you give me the opportunity to talk about this issue, but this is a perfect thing. Like what we were talking about with architects are in this position. There's a technical aspect. There's an educational aspect. Like people don't even know that this exists. And then there's the design, you know, like how do we do it beautifully, elegantly, you know, and it's, yes, we need regulation because, you know, when I remember growing up and that like there was no law that said you had to wear a seatbelt, so people didn't wear them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it's just like, it's a so simple thing. So with bird strikes and buildings, it's, there's actually just, there's zones that are more difficult than others. It's not like to say every piece of glass has to follow these rules. So I'm working hard right now on getting our city in Chicago to adopt regulations for bird safety. Because I think a lot of times maybe architects don't even know, you know, the solutions. So it's just something, it's one of those problems that in a way architects are very positioned well to help solve it. Because if you're only looking at it from the bird ornithology point of view, it's a problem. It has to be solved, but you don't know what to do to solve it. If you're looking at it from the other end of the spectrum, let's say, you know, it's concern about cost or something from a developer trying to do a new building, there's a fear and like, no, we don't want to have these rules. And so there is a place where you can find out where it's effective, what kinds of things can be done, and you can work with industry to come up with interesting solutions. Mm-hmm. So I think it's such a great example of what architects can do. And of course, as an environmentalist myself and as a person who loves living things, I care deeply about it. Like when you see the numbers of of how many birds are killed annually running into buildings that they can't see. It's one of these complex things. It's not just one situation. So it takes some, you know, education, but architects are capable of it. I mean, come on. Mm-hmm. We can handle like multiple issues. I mean, there's the issue of transparency, which is most difficult, like on, let's say, those glass bridges that go across. And there's the difficulty of reflection that we have with certain types of glass, and lighting and various different things. But they're all not that complicated if you just look at each particular thing.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to maybe still keep talking about or continue talking about advocacy, but we're running out of time.
Okay.
So maybe we go to this sort of in this same recent monograph, GSD's former dean, Mohsen Mostafavi, describes your work in the kind of two main categories, the kind of the very large, tall buildings. He says the focus on exteriority and arrested movement, emblematic of many of the large-scale projects, is countered by greater attention to interiority in many of the smaller buildings. In these projects, the use and performance of the building often go hand in hand with its material and construction qualities. And I was wondering if you agree with this characterization, and can we talk about the kinds of criteria that you tend to have when making material and tectonic choices? And we already talked about building having vibes or beauty, but I'm quoting you, sort of building having vibes strong enough to invite users and stewards. And I'm imagining that there are sort of links between these concerns.
Yeah, I think similar to how we were talking about clients are different and how they make decisions, there's also different places you can have impact, let's say, in the form of a building, depending on its scale and on its use. And how do you find that place that you can help it? And I think with tall buildings, I've always been interested in the exteriority, like occupying the exterior of it. And, you know, mind you, in the beginning when we did the Aqua Tower, there were not tall buildings with balconies. They didn't exist. And it was just something that was like, wow, that's just so missing. How can you get the outside space that you have in a smaller dwelling? So that was really a focus and a drive. And then, you know, how those buildings perform in their environments and how they meet the ground. And those are kind of the things to deal with when it comes to tall buildings. Because inside, it's almost like infrastructure. You just have, you know, there's a lot of people accommodated there. And of course, they have their own taste. They have their own style. And I love that. I want them to, you know, do their own thing. And I don't want to control every action of every person that lives in a high rise. I want them to be able to express themselves in that building type. And then on the smaller scale building where you're creating an environment like a theater or a museum or a space where there's public engagement to come and experience it, there's just a lot more opportunity to work spatially with light, with you know, the way that people, the choreography of the movement through the space, I would say, and just that, so you are in charge of that experience. It's not the same as a residential thing where I want the person that lives there to be in charge of their private space. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I guess they're different just because they're so different. I mean, but again, you need to know that, or don't waste your efforts on something that is not in your purview. Mm-hmm.
So I just saw the announcement that you're building at Harvard, the David Rubenstein Treehouse, or the Harvard Enterprise Research Campus, is breaking ground, and it is Harvard's first mass timber building. And what do you think of that? or how has it been working on that?
Well, it's such an honor to work at Harvard, a place that I've been so connected to for so long, and to do a project that's what I like programmatically is it's a conference center, so it's not, you know, just part of a private hotel that's used as a conference center. It is our conference center and can be used by different groups in Harvard and doing mass timber construction, but at the same time working with all of the standards and everything that Harvard has from their vast experience of making buildings. That's the kind of key challenge of it. And, you know, together as partners and with Tishman Speyer too, we're getting there and we're going to get there. So it's pretty cool. You know, it made me think about like, where does the wood come from? You know, one step is getting a building of a renewable material, but then is where does this material come from? So there's a lot in that that I'm really interested in right now. And that's kind of like the result of working on this project in a certain way.
All right, we have just a few more questions. How big is your studio now? And do you have any procedures in place by which you both expose the office or studio to the realities of running the office? And do you invite your team to think collectively about the commissions you will and will not take?
I'd say, you know, for just the purposes of efficiency, we have a smaller group really weighing those pros and cons in the beginning, and then it gets presented to a slightly larger group that discusses it further. And then if we do decide to take something, we do, you know, tell people that this is something we're doing and why. And that's an interesting question because, like, one example that I have of that is when we were invited to compete for the Theodore Roosevelt Museum Library. And, you know, this was right at exactly at the time when there's all this controversy about Theodore Roosevelt statue in front of the AM&H. So it was really close to home. But that was such an interesting example because we weren't just going after this to be like, you know, here's a museum in the cap and another commission. It, to me, it presented an opportunity to really drill down into this issue of like the legacy of a person that on the one hand did some amazing things for conservation in the United States, and but then had other aspects of his time and his personality that were, you know, to us seem objectionable. So, but the organizers of the competition were, you know, assuring us they wanted to do an even-handed like representation of this person. And it's such an important person in the history of US. So I didn't want to say no. And again, it wasn't because this is prestigious. This is, you know, a big fee. It was just because it's interesting and it brings forth these difficult aspects. And so what we did as a group, when we explained this is something we're going to be doing, here's the team, we made a kind of a reading list, a book list of a variety of books about Roosevelt and his legacy. And then we had a book club on that. So that was kind of ongoing. And it was so interesting. I mean, and I think in the beginning, there was like a young person in the office who said, I don't want to work on that. But then when we started to work through these really, you know, interesting, difficult issues, you know, that kind of went away and like everybody wanted to work on it. But so that's just an example of, you know, that it's not a democratic process of how we decide to go after work, but we do try to, you know, flush it out with everyone at the right time.
This is the last one for you.
Okay.
How would you describe the conditions in which Studio Gang does its best work? Are all commissions equally exciting? Are there ideal commissions, ideal circumstances for commission?
I think the best work is done when there's just, you know, a real, I would say from a mission perspective lockstep with our client and whoever that is. But then that there is pushback and tensions about what, you know, is being proposed and how it will be made. And it's, I mean, there needs to be some tension there too, to make it really good. And, you know, I mean, it's kind of a cliche that people say a good client makes a good project, but there's truth to it in that if both the architect and the client are really committed to this visionary thing that they want, then, you know, it's going to be better than if it's like, say someone is, I've had the situation where people came and say, can you just do another Aqua Tower? You know, so, you know, cause that was good. And we just want that, but you know, that's a bit difficult, because, you know, and so, I think that's true, that the best work comes out of this productive tension and cultivating what those points are going to be. It's so that you can sort through them together.
Excellent.
All right.
Jeannie, thank you very much for talking to me today. And listeners, thank you for listening to this episode of I Would Prefer Not To.
Thanks, Anna. That was so much fun talking about the subject.